Welcome into the Wednesday, November 14th, 2012 edition of God and Culture, the Paul Edwards program. What to do with Thomas Jefferson is the question we'll attempt to deal with and answer here on the podcast today with Dr. Warren Throckmorton, author of the new book, Getting Jefferson Right. It's interesting, isn't it, that both left and right on evangelicalism in some measure claim Thomas Jefferson when it comes to the question of the separation of church and state. My friends on the left, like Jim Wallace and the Reverend Barry Lynn, will be quick to cite the Danbury letter of Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptist, indicating that there is a wall of separation between church and state. David Barton, on the other hand, the Christian historian, would be quick to say that my friends on the left are wrong, that Jefferson was not a radical atheist interested in abolishing religion and interested, in fact, in the separation of church and state. He would call it the myth of the separation of church and state. So the question becomes, who's right and who's wrong? You've got folks on the right, folks on the left in evangelical Christianity who are claiming Jefferson. Who is right and who is wrong? This is why it's so important to get Jefferson right. Dr. Warren Throckmorton is Associate Professor of Psychology at Grove City College, and he talked with me this week about getting Jefferson right.
It's interesting, isn't it, that both sides in the separation of church and state debate appeal to Thomas Jefferson. You've got David Barton on the one side, along with the late D. James Kennedy and the very much alive Kirk Cameron and others who will appeal to Jefferson to say that he was one of the founders that would have been not opposed to the separation of church and state, his letter to the Danbury Baptist notwithstanding. But then on the left, you've got my friend Barry Lynn, mm-hmm. who will appeal to Thomas Jefferson for strict separation of church and state. How is it that Jefferson is in the middle of all of this?
That's a great question. I think both sides of so many debates want Jefferson on their team because he wrote one of the charter documents. His authorship of the Declaration makes his other writings of interest, because then you start to look at, well, what did he mean by what he wrote in the Declaration? Well, let's look at what else he wrote and what else he had to say on the topics, and we can, get some idea of what he meant and how he might think about things today. And, I think anybody wants one of the founders on their team. Jefferson had a lot to say about the separation of religion and government. He had a lot to say about how the institutional church had limited freedom, and he had a lot to say about the subject. And so at various times, you can hear him sounding quite supportive of religion. He himself was a religious man. He was not an atheist, as some have claimed. He was not an Orthodox Christian, as David Barton implies and has claimed that he was early in his life. But he did believe in a God and had very definite ideas about where the church had perverted the moral teaching of Jesus. So when you read Jefferson on Jesus and his views of what Christianity should be, it can sound like he would have had no trouble with mixing politics and religion, but when you read his defense of the freedom of conscience and his Virginia Act to disestablish the church there and for religious freedom, then that supports the other side, in a sense, the side that says there should be a clear separation between the workings of the civil magistrate and the operation of the church or religion, as however it's expressed.
So what do we have here, Dr. Throckmorton? Do we have a case of selective reading on both sides? And how do we, I mean, in your book, Getting Jefferson Right, did you boil Jefferson down to get away from, to be a little bit more dispassionate, so that you don't have a right view or a left view? You've come to some conclusion about who Jefferson was. I mean, you've got his writings on religious freedom on the one hand and his religious views on the other hand. Who is Thomas Jefferson when it boils down to his view on the separation of church and state?
Well, it is a difficult task to boil him down to a philosophy. He had a lot to say about it, but to say that he had a systematic philosophy on the subject, I think would not quite be accurate. He certainly believed that you should resist tyranny, whether it be in the church or whether it be in the civil realm. He did believe that there were real abuses in the institutional church, and resisted very strongly any idea of establishing a church. And he said clearly that his work in Virginia to establish freedom of conscience did not just extend to Christian sects, you know, Christian denominations, that he had in mind all religions. And so there is this view among those who tend to follow David Barton that the First Amendment really only applies to differences among Christian denominations. But Jefferson, you know, he certainly did not agree with that as an approach. He said clearly that the extent of the coverage of freedom of conscience extends to, and he included Islam, and he included other religions and no religion, so that the state cannot compel somebody to believe a certain way. And I think there is a selective reading of Jefferson. We really looked at the selective reading more on the Christian right, but I think there is a selective reading of Jefferson on the far left too, say that he didn't want any even discussion of religion or any reference to religion in public life. He did hope that his own particular view might get some currency. He had discussions with Benjamin Rush about how that Christianity formed a good basis for Republican government. What he meant by that was that Christianity, as he understood it, emphasized moral treatment of your fellow citizen, you know, that you should do to others as the way you want them to do to you. Well, if people act that way, you won't need many laws. If that's how people treat each other, for whatever reason, whether it's because they believe in the golden rule as it comes from Jesus or as it's expressed in other world religions, if you do this, then the government wouldn't have to do quite as much. And that's really the extent of Jefferson's interest in religion, how it helped a moral citizenry.
Right. So, but Jefferson wouldn't have felt that it was, and I'm not making a statement in the question. I'm asking a question. Jefferson would not have felt that it would be the role of government to inculcate that sense of do unto others as you would have others do unto you?
Well, I think he would be fine with government supporting that idea. But when it comes to telling people how they should conduct their religion, how they should live their or how they should think, you know, he said he resisted that and swore an enmity against that. Very strong language, really, as to the role of the government telling people how to think. So I think that he and the other founders, many of the other founders, would want a moral citizenry and believe that the Constitution was designed for such people. But to impose that or coerce that was foreign to Jefferson's thinking, at least.
In the introduction to your book, Getting Jefferson Right, you and your colleague Michael Coulter indicate that it's your desire to to simply see Jefferson in the context of his times, the statements that he makes in the context in which he made them. And you spend a bit of time in the introduction talking about the what drives the conclusions of David Barton in terms of the deconstructionism. And, you know, when evangelical Christians who are informed hear words like deconstruction and minimalist, those are big words to us that raise red flags. And Barton has done a good job of raising those flags. I mean, if you call somebody a deconstructionist, he's automatically written off in the evangelical world, I think. Mm-hmm. Talk for a moment about your view of deconstructionism, Michael Foucault and others, that, you know, guys like David Barton would take probably a more offensive view of, that you know, they wouldn't readily identify with these guys. But do you feel like Barton is misrepresenting some of the views of men like Foucault and other deconstructionists?
Well, we do. We took a look at, in our book, the way that Barton defined these terms and the way that they're typically defined among historians. And there really is some variance between the definitions of these terms. Barton seems to characterize deconstructionism as a criticism of America, you know, that people use history with an agenda to make America look bad, and so they deconstruct the positive role of America in the world in such a way that only the negative things that have happened become focused. And he specifically accuses the academic elite for doing that. He also uses the word post-structuralism and says that that's where Michael Foucault is involved, you know, saying that the church or that academics have been affected by post-structuralism. And what we do is we take a look at what we think Barton is doing and actually find that he does very much the same thing as what he accuses others of doing. Whatever term you use, it's never right to simply pick and choose facts or events and arrange them in a certain way to create an impression in your reader that is not historically accurate. And clearly, people on the left have done that. They've picked out certain events where American administrations have done things that are not worthy, and then reduces the entire government experiment to that. Well, you know, Mr. Barton on the other side ignores the whole picture. And what we try to do in the book is to see it all, just to get Jefferson right, to get the facts right. A great example of this kind of discussion is Jefferson and slavery. Jefferson did own slaves. I think everybody knows that. One might try to minimize Jefferson's role as a slave owner and to construct him as a benign, sort of passive slave owner who really couldn't help it and had no other option, and that's what David Barton does. Or, on the other side of things, you could make Jefferson look like an ogre, you know, like he was worse, morally speaking, for his times because of his ownership of slaves and his lack of strong involvement in the abolition movement after about 1782. Now, we think that both pictures would be incomplete. It would be important to see all the relationship Jefferson had to his own slaves and to slavery as an institution, to see everything he said and did about it. And when you do that, you find that David Barton is a post-structuralist. Hmm. He's a deconstructionist. He leaves out, and I mean literally leaves out, important data from quotes of Jefferson, from the Law of Virginia. I mean, just doesn't include it when it would be relevant to seeing a full picture of Jefferson as a slave owner. And we think that's wrong, and certainly not becoming to a Christian scholar.
Yeah, one of the illustrations of that is Jefferson's so-called call for a religious image from the Old Testament on a coin, which Barton touts, you know, the children of Israel in the wilderness. But it correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Barton conveniently leaves out the flip side of the coin literally.
Oh, that's right. There was a need to come up with a seal for the United States at the very beginning. And there was, you know, Ben Franklin and John Adams and Jefferson looking at what could we include. And Jefferson had two ideas. One is the children of Israel being led to freedom. But on the other side of the seal, he wanted Hengist and Horsa, who were pagan Saxons that really kept Christianity from flourishing in England in the 800s-900s. So, you know, on one side, he wanted the children of Israel led by a cloud and a pillar of fire by night, and on the other side, these Saxon chiefs who were pagans. Now, Barton tells you about the children of Israel in the wilderness that Jefferson wanted on the seal, but he completely ignores the other side with the appeal to Hengist and Horsa. And in point of fact, John Adams said, when he was describing this to his wife, he said about Hengist and Horsa, "We claim the honor of being descended and whose political principles and form of government we have assumed."
Mm.
I mean, it's even worse than just leaving it out.
Yeah.
Adams said that the Saxon kings, these pagan kings, were the originators of common law in Britain, not Christianity, as you know, David Barton would have us believe. So both Jefferson and Adams both thought that that Christianity was not a part of common law. And see, if you include that story about Hengist and Horsa, you have to go further then and disconfirm another thing that David Barton claims, and that is that our common law and our system of government is founded on the Bible, when in point of fact, that's not at least what Adams and Jefferson thought.
You again, in the introduction to your book, point out that part of the reason why, or one of the reasons why, or some assumptions we can make about Jefferson's attendance at a worship service in the Capitol, or his support of Bible reading among Indians, not for evangelism, but really for reading purposes or whatever, is because, and I found this very interesting, you say that Jefferson is not primarily a philosopher. Certainly he's not a theologian. That comes at no surprise. But he's primarily a politician. So how does that account for some of what we see Jefferson doing that seems to contradict his writings on the separation of church and state, vis-a-vis him being in the Capitol for a Christian worship service?
Mm. Well, that's a really interesting aspect of Jefferson's of the timing of Jefferson's attendance at those services. The campaign of 1800 between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson was extraordinarily negative. Many people have said that the current campaign that just concluded between Romney and Obama was negative. Well, you need to read history because Jefferson called Adams names, and Adams and his followers accused Jefferson of being an atheist and an infidel, and that if Jefferson was elected, you better bury your Bibles. I guess people actually did bury their Bibles in the backyard because Jefferson was going to come and get them, you know. And
that sounds vaguely familiar in the recently ended campaign.
It does. If you read some of the far right response to the election of Obama, that's kind of saying the same thing. Well, Jefferson didn't go get any Bibles, and he wasn't an Orthodox man. He certainly wasn't an atheist. But that was the belief, and he wrote his friends about this. He was quite stung by it, actually, because He talked to his friend Benjamin Rush and says, you know, I am a Christian, only in the way that any Jesus would want anybody to be, someone who follows his teachings. Now, Jesus' teachings for Thomas Jefferson didn't include anything about his deity or any miracles or anything like that. It only included something like the Golden Rule and the Sermon on the Mount, you know, treating people well. And that's what he thought Jesus taught. So in that way, Jefferson thought of himself as a Christian. But he didn't come out and talk about it. It wasn't part of his platform. He just kind of suffered these accusations in silence. So very close to the time of the election, it turns out that the House of Representatives had to settle this because it was just too close to call. There weren't enough electoral votes for any one candidate. It was about that time that the chaplains approached the House of Representatives to establish worship services. Now, they didn't call it a church. They just said they wanted to have divine services in the Capitol building on Sundays. There were very few churches, and maybe a couple of churches established in the District of Columbia at that time. It was very understandable that they would want to have, in one of the few public buildings available, divine services there. And so Jefferson had no say in it, but he was the president of the Senate at the time. He probably could have said something about it if he opposed it, but had he done that, he might have jeopardized his election because he already was viewed as an infidel. And I don't think he needed a new religious controversy. Jefferson stops church in the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he had no jurisdiction. He would have had to gone out of his way to try to stop worship services in the Capitol. We don't know if he expressed an opinion. We don't know if he had an opinion. He never wrote about it. We just know that they went ahead and had divine services. Jefferson attended a few of those. Off and on, he attended them while he was president. And the basic idea you get from looking at Jefferson's writings about religion is that he thought it was kind of a benign influence. And so for him to attend services in the Capitol does seem to go against some other things that he did and said. For instance, Jefferson did not declare days of thanksgiving during his two terms. He said that the government should not get involved in how a man worships God. And so he refused to declare days of prayer, days of thanksgiving, as other presidents had done before and after him. But he did attend church in the House of Representatives. We don't know all of why he did that, but as I say, particularly in the beginning, had he done that, it would have it would have made the Federalists look right. See, he is an infidel.
Mm.
He is an atheist. He doesn't want us to worship God, and he decided best we can tell, just not to say anything.
Well, that's the battle cry of the religious right every National Day of Prayer, the first Thursday in May. President Obama, I may be mistaken about this, but I don't think in his first administration he ever declared that as a National Day of Prayer. He may have issued some statement, I don't know, but the religious right tends to paint President Obama as an infidel because mm-hmm. he doesn't necessarily walk in lockstep with the kind of high holy days that they think the president ought to be declaring. And and I'm no Obama apologist, but this may not be a reflection of Obama's personal faith as much as it is the Jeffersonian idea of I just don't think it's the president's place to be declaring religious events.
Right, and I think that that may be part of it as well as more of a political calculation. I mean, very clearly the National Day of Prayer has become associated with evangelicalism. And, you know, it's a diverse country with many different religions. And I think as we've seen in the election, the Democrats have done a much better job reaching out to diverse groups than the Republicans have. And so when you have a day of prayer that is essentially an evangelical event, you don't look terribly inclusive. I will say that the president has been a supporter of the National Prayer Breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another huge event in March that is put on by a Christian group, but is much more inclusive of other religious traditions. And so it's not that he just avoids anything religious. He is involved in that and has spoken at the National Prayer Breakfast and given his support to it.
What is the genesis of your debate, Dr. Throckmorton, with David Barton? You are a professor of psychology at Grove City. How does a professor of psychology take an interest in these issues, and where did this start, and where is it at, and is it still ongoing, this debate between you and Barton?
Okay. Well, it does seem a little odd, doesn't it? My interest, though, goes back to, let's see. I think what we could say, what I can say is, in my teaching about psychology and counseling as a profession, I embed the profession within the social need that gave rise to it. And that was primarily the move from agriculture to industrialization. And that's when counseling really kind of came into its own. And so how did that profession develop? It developed in a pluralistic society. It's developed a code of ethics that has that demands respect for all views, and I think that's an American value. And you see it in the First Amendment. You see it in the fact that in the charter documents, there's no test for religion. There's no religious test. So you can hold office, and that was a big deal at the time because some of the states still had state churches at the time where you did have a religious test. But for the federal government, and this was a departure, there would be no religious test. So it is an American value to say that to participate in the government, to participate in our democracy, you don't have to believe a certain way. So to me, the First Amendment is important to my profession too. And I'd been doing some research on that and ran into David Barton's work. And there were some who was using his work to say that the First Amendment didn't apply to other religions. And the more I got into some of the claims that Mr. Barton makes about the Founding Fathers and claim about, for instance, that the first Bible was printed by Congress, which is not true, but he says it, you know, he says it incessantly. I thought that it was odd that somebody could say these things in such a public way and not be called out on it. So I started writing blog posts and articles about the claims and, you know, fact-checking them. You were kind of in the beginning of this too, Paul, because you recall having David Barton on the show.
Yep.
You'd offered to have him come on with me, but
right.
He wouldn't do it. And so I came on after him, and that was a real pivotal point for me. When I listened to how he responded to some of those claims, I thought, well, I think he's not just mistaken. He really knows what he's doing. So I just got more interested in it. And when I heard that he was going to write a book on Thomas Jefferson, I decided I would put together these articles that I had written into a book. And that was the starting of it. That was the beginning of the book, Getting Jefferson Right. As I got into it, it just took on a life of its own. I mean, it just expanded, and there were more claims that we saw in the book that we wanted to respond to, and I asked Michael Coulter, and I say we, I asked a fellow professor here, Michael Coulter, to come on board. Michael has real expertise in the history of political ideas and is a John Locke scholar, so he seemed like a natural.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's where the book came from. We first brought it out as an e-book on Amazon, and because of requests, we then brought it out as a paperback. And my understanding is that the publisher of The Jefferson Lies somehow got a copy of the book, and that was somehow involved in their decision making.
Yeah, Zondervan, I think, when was it, in August, pulled The Jefferson Lies?
Well, it's Thomas Nelson, but yes, in August, they... Well, you know, it's the backstory on that is that apparently Thomas Nelson had pulled the book off their website about a week or two before it became known. It had been an open secret for a week or so before the Tennessean did a story, and then World Magazine also broke the story that Thomas Nelson had pulled it. So once it became clear it wasn't on the website anymore, both of those entities went to Thomas Nelson and got statements from them that they had found deficiencies in the book and felt it was in their best interest to stop publication.
Have you had any conversations with David Barton personally off the record, or have you had the opportunity to debate him, as I wanted to do on my radio program, to bring you both on and have a give and take about these issues? And if that's not happened, is it potential that it could happen?
Well, the potential, start at the end there, the potential seems remote because the answer is yes, I've offered, others have offered to have a debate. Certainly you did. The Blaze, which is Glenn Beck's media outlet, I mean, that's a friendly venue for him.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to go on with us, but they had him on, and then they had us on for what they call a Blaze cast. It was kind of a webcast where he responded to some of our charges, although mostly he just called us names. But the second aspect of it is that we got to go on and respond to him, but he wouldn't ever come on at the same time. Early on, I reached out to him. I sent emails and left phone messages, but there's been no response.
As we wrap this up, Dr. Throckmorton, what does it matter? Why does it matter what view we take of Thomas Jefferson and his view of the separation of church and state? Why is what David Barton is espousing, why is it so important to you to do some fact checking and come alongside with another viewpoint?
Well, you know, on one hand, it's not that important for what we do now, because the country's a vastly different place than when Thomas Jefferson wrote about it. And so I'm not of the school of thought that thinks that if we could just figure out what Jefferson meant, then we could know what to do now. But so many other people do think that. And so if we're going to have discussions about the separation of church and state, or the relationship between civil law and religious belief, we need to be basing those conversations on fact. And that's where I see real problems with the kind of narratives that David Barton advances. He wants to have a conversation that's skewed toward a certain outcome. And, you know, people will read his materials, and they'll get into conversations, and they'll say, you know, Thomas Jefferson was a born-again Christian, and he really meant this, and he did that, and they're arguing based on falsehood. And I think the church has been deceived by it. So our small contribution is to get the facts straight. We see that as the first duty of a Christian scholar, is to whatever you think, however you think things should turn out, however you think the policy should go, start with the facts. And it seems to me that Christians just really, without question, should want to get those facts right and would not want to knowingly spread false information. So that in and of itself is enough reason. And then that becomes the foundation for having conversations about important matters in the society, about how should religion and government interact.
Dr. Warren Throckmorton is Associate Professor of Psychology at Grove City College, and he is a Fellow for Psychology and Public Policy at the Center for Vision and Values. His book co-authored with Michael Coulter, Getting Jefferson Right, Fact-Checking Claims About Our Third President. You can just go to gettingjeffersonright.com. Is that it? .com?
That's it. That's right.
Gettingjeffersonright.com. The book is there, and all the background information on the authors are there as well. And Warren, it's always a joy to chat with you. We've got other things that we need to talk about, and we'll do those on some other podcasts coming up.
That sounds great. Thanks, Paul.